and welcome to Quality Blether, the Scottish Testing Group podcast, where you don't have to be Scottish or a tester to have quality conversations about quality. I'm your host, Brian Jones, and my guest today is James Christie. James is a very experienced tester with an unusual background. He also writes an excellent blog. It was that combination of background and his blog that put him in a special position when the Post Office Horizon scandal escalated into the public consciousness. Hello, James. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Brian. Thank you. Good to be here.
Your route into testing wasn't exactly the stereotypical one. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in testing?
Well, I studied economics and accounting at university, and that was what I started off doing. But I switched fairly quickly into IT. That was what really fascinated me. And because of my financial background, I got to work in a lot of interesting financial applications. And after a few years in development, I moved into computer audit, spent a few years there, and then was brought back into a team leading role in development. And from there, I moved into, I was pulled into software test management and Y2K because of my extensive financial experience. I was put in charge of the conversion and testing of a series of financial systems. From there, I kept on saying yes when I got interesting phone calls offering me new opportunities. I moved into information security management for a few years before returning to testing. And so as a result, I've worked in most of the areas, the main areas, which are relevant to the Post Office scandal, software development, testing, financial systems, working on big outsourced accounts with IBM, IT audit and security management. And so I can see how things went wrong in all of these areas. And that's why I've got involved. I wrote about my view of what was going on, and that was spotted by Nick Wallace, who wrote the book, The Great Post Office Scandal. And he put me in touch with people who are campaigning to try and get the law changed in England and to try and ensure that some postmasters get the justice they deserve.
You've been writing a blog for many years now. You started in, 2010?
That's right, yes.
And a lot of the content on your blog, I must say, is really interesting. It's excellent content in its own right. And that was before the Post Office scandal took off in the public awareness. So you end up talking about quite a lot of really relevant modern subjects to testing in your blog. For instance, the excessive effort that's put into writing test scripts and detailed test plans and documentation as a whole that's not necessarily ideal for the situation, especially with moving requirements. Now, that seems to have come from your experience. You want to talk a little bit about that side of it, the how testing has become almost like dogma?
Yeah, well, one of the great benefits of spending a few years as an IT auditor is that you have to sit back and think about the bigger picture, how everything fits together. And you're taught to question why things are done and to identify areas where, well, people are doing things simply because that's the way they've always been done. They're simply following an established process without realizing that that's no longer relevant to the problem they're trying to deal with. And I could see that the way that many testers were working was they were simply following a fairly detailed process without thinking about what they were trying to achieve, what value they were trying to provide to their employers to the people who needed to understand how the system might work. A phrase that came to mind was that as a test manager, I was sometimes being asked not to manage the testing, but to manage the testing process. And you know, a lot of IT programs, when it came to the testing, they weren't looking for useful information about what the system was doing, but they were looking, they wanted to be able to tick the boxes to say that they'd done the steps that they were expected to do to knock off the milestones on the project plan without really having done any worthwhile testing. And that was something that I found very frustrating. It really went against everything that I'd been taught and that I learned when I was working as an IT auditor, when you're always told to question the status quo, to challenge what people were doing and to make them justify what they were doing, to explain the rationale behind it so that people weren't simply doing things because that was the habit, that was what the process laid down, then they're simply doing things without really providing any great value to anyone.
You write quite a lot about the difference between testing and checking and the similarity with testing and auditing and how it should be an exploratory thing rather than a tick box exercise. Do you think that is still a prevalent problem in the industry these days?
I hope not. I hope that we've advanced a bit beyond that. That was certainly a huge problem 10, 20 years ago. I hope it's a bit better now. Well, what do you think about that? Do you think people are still stuck with that?
I think there's a tendency in human nature to like nice, easy frameworks, to yes. put things in boxes, to be able to just go tick, tick, tick. And then on the flip side of that coin is curiosity, which is something I go on an awful lot about. Anybody that's talked to me for any length of time would know this. Curiosity is that exploration, is that learning.
I certainly do think it's still a huge problem in IT audit because it's a very easy job to do badly, to have relatively unskilled people, relatively poorly paid people who are simply following an audit plan with questions. And they ask, have you done this? And simply expecting an answer, yes or no. And if a series of no's are provided, then a critical audit report is written. And that's always been a huge problem in IT audit.
I think this is a bigger industry issue then, that what sort of impact does it have on the industry?
It's very dangerous because it means that people don't understand what's going on. People, as you were suggesting, people rely on checklists, on pre-written rather narrowly focused test plans because it's easier to do the job. It's easier to get a grip on what they're doing. They're doing the easy things. And increasingly, I think when we're dealing with complex software systems, we're going to have to try and explain what they can do, what we know about these systems and what we don't know. The danger, if you rely too heavily on testing that's driven purely by the requirement specification, is that you're taking far too narrow a perspective. You're looking only, it's like you're not trying to shine a light on the dark areas that we don't know anything about. You're focusing on what it is relatively easy to say something about, the requirements that have been documented and without exploring about the potential problems with the system. When we were doing a system audit for for IT systems, we never actually looked at the requirements, because we'd start off by speaking to the users to understand what the system had to do, what the risks associated with it were, and to understand what needed to happen and what must not happen. And if we went back to focus on the original requirements, we would simply waste time trying to confirm that the system matched the flawed and fairly limited understanding of those who had originally developed it and tested it. Because systems are, they're sort of like living beings. They're always evolving, they're being adapted. They're having to adapt to a changing business environment, to changing problems. And if you focus too closely on how the requirements are viewed at one point in time, you can lose sight of what the system needs to do at a later stage when it's live, when it's been running for a few years, when the users have maybe been using it in ways that weren't expected. That was a problem with the Post Office's Horizon system. Users didn't necessarily, well, they weren't using it in exactly the way that it was expected, and the system wasn't able to cope with that, and that resulted in problems in what I would have called bugs, but which the Post Office insisted were user errors, because the Post Office didn't understand exactly how people were using the system in the real world.
I really like your metaphor of shining light on the dark areas. There seems to be quite a lot of synergy between testing and audit. But again, you mentioned the Post Office scandal. That's certainly become a hot topic these days. A month ago, I believe your blog suddenly started receiving 100 times as many hits as normal because of that interest in it.
Yes, it was exactly when the ITV drama Mr. Bates versus the Post Office started. It started at 9 o'clock on New Year's Day, and halfway through, I checked the blog traffic, and it was just going crazy. So people were searching for more information about it as it was being shown, and over the following days and weeks, the whole thing just took off.
So, what would you say were the main factors that caused that problem? That caused the situation that so badly affected so many people?
There were so many different factors, but I think at root it was Horizon was a system that was over ambitious, that was developed by a supplier that wasn't really competent to deliver such a complex distributed system, and they weren't sufficiently responsible to recognize that and to tender responsibly. They won the contract because they were the cheapest supplier. Other suppliers like IBM, they tendered, but they tendered more realistically with much higher prices. And although ICL Fujitsu scored lower on almost every criteria, they were the cheapest. And from that point on, everything was going wrong. The development was seriously flawed. It was appallingly managed and performed. And the Post Office failed to manage the relationship effectively. Part of the reason for that was political, because the government, the Labour government at the time, was keen to maintain good relationships with Fujitsu in Japan. But also there was a serious failure to understand what was required to develop such a system.
You mentioned the underbidding to win, the lost leader effect of deliberately bidding low. Do you think, I've seen that quite a lot in the industry, Do you think that's going to reduce now? Do you think companies are now going to be scared of doing that underestimation, deliberate underestimation?
I hope so. I hope that clients will be less naive than they were in the past, less naive than the post office and the government were. I think Fujitsu probably deliberately underbid, but the level of incompetence that they've shown was such that it's possible that they genuinely didn't have a clue. However, the contract was written in such a way that although it was cheap up front, it proved to be inordinately expensive when the inevitable changes had mm-hmm. to be made.
That's a very common model, isn't it? They bid low it and is, then the yes. changes are expensive.
And it's obviously proved to be horrendously expensive in the longer run, now that massive compensations having to be paid out. Although, of course, if Fujitsu's poor development and their poor management of Horizon would not have been all that significant. We'd never have heard about Horizon if the post office had acted responsibly themselves. It was a combination of an incompetent, irresponsible supplier with a client that was duplicitous, dishonest, incompetent themselves, and also hopelessly naive about complex computer systems. They chose to believe that Horizon was entirely reliable without questioning the accuracy of the data, the information they were getting from it.
I know that Post Office have their own IT capability and have had for quite a long time. Do you know whether they were actually involved in any way? Did they have any visibility of what Fujitsu were doing or the reporting from Fujitsu or any of that sort of thing?
Well, actually, that's a very important point. Yes, the Post Office did have its own in-house IT capability. And, well, companies who outsource need that. They need people who can manage the relationship and who can monitor developments, who can audit them, and who can test the final product. The post office testers, I've got a great deal of sympathy for, because they were hampered by two huge problems. They were not given effective support by their own management, who were hoping that everything would go smoothly and who didn't want to hear about problems that the testers were having. And the testers themselves did not have sufficient visibility of what Fujitsu were doing, of the system that was being built. That was the second problem. And that was attributable in large part to the contract that was written. It was a PFI contract, you know, public finance initiative. And Fujitsu's interpretation of that was that they were providing a service to the post office. They were not building a system to hand over to the post office. And their attitude was the system was theirs and they were only delivering the service, the accounting service to the post office. And that so therefore the post office and their testers should only be inspecting and testing the output. Fujitsu were arguing that the post office testers had no right to know about the detail of Horizon, to know about the detailed design.
That's a model that's quite broadly used as well, the idea of service and service management being delivered into the client, and that the client doesn't need to know what's going on. It's been seen in an awful lot of government contracts. Do you think that's going to become less prevalent? That's going to fall out of grace?
Well, I hope so, because in this case, there were potential problems that the post office testers were concerned about. and which they did not get the chance to test before the system went live. They were concerned about Fujitsu's grasp of accounting principles. They thought that the Fujitsu developers didn't sufficiently understand the implications of accounting transactions being lost. They thought that Fujitsu developers were focusing too much on the happy path.
Mm-hmm. And as we know, that's always a mistake to focus on happy path.
Yes, and they weren't thinking about ensuring that the system could cope with problems and that it would be able to highlight serious discrepancies and problems. It was simply focusing on what ought to happen rather than it being built so that it would ensure that the wrong things wouldn't happen. And the post office testers continually got resistance from Fujitsu when they were trying to find out about that when the system was being designed. It was impossible for them to perform any sort of early testing. And to make matters worse, the final acceptance was done on live rather than in a formal acceptance testing phase. And because it was live, there was endless repetition of successful transactions, the happy path, without possible failure scenarios being forced in to see how the system would cope with that. Mm-hmm. And when the system went live across the whole UK, in hindsight, we can now see that many of the problems that caused discrepancies at individual branches were down to communications and hardware failures that Horizon was unable to cope with.
There was a recent case in America, wasn't there, of the testing in live of a lottery system. And a man thought he'd won $340 million on this lottery. And in fact, it was just a test in live that had basically gone public.
Well, this wasn't quite the same in the case of the post office. It was real live running. And that was being treated as the final acceptance testing. There wasn't a realistic acceptance testing phase before that, before it went live, in which they could ensure that failure scenarios were properly tested.
Do you think that the Fujitsu team didn't have the time available and the budget available because of this cut price approach? Do you think it was a management forced situation as opposed to something the testers themselves would want to do?
Yes, I'm sure it was. But they also clearly didn't have sufficient development expertise. The standard of developers was extremely low, according to the evidence that's come out in the post office inquiry. There was some fairly damning evidence from a contract development manager who was put in and was appalled by the level of expertise in the staff, in the development staff. And it was so bad that the Fujitsu sent over people from Japan to do a code audit. But yes, the system was certainly, it was certainly rushed in quicker than it should have been. But yeah, it was one of these cases where almost everything went wrong. There was a lot of pressure on people who weren't sufficiently competent, and there wasn't adequate management scrutiny to ensure that the whole development was being performed responsibly. And the client, the post office, didn't want to confront Fujitsu and respond to the concerns that are being flagged up to senior management. Really, anything that could have gone wrong did go wrong.
So it's not a single root cause, it's a very complex systemic root cause or causes.
Definitely, yes. Yes.
You mentioned audit earlier. Was there any actual IT audit that they could do, or was that prohibited by the contract? Could they actually get in and see anything at all?
The post office testers were flagging up their concerns about about Fujitsu's interpretation of the contract. And a few years down the line, it did get rewritten. Now, if the post office was hived off from Royal Mail in 2012, so at the time of the original development, the Royal Mail Group internal audit function would have been responsible. And this was a massive development, and they should have been following it extremely closely. If they were doing their jobs responsibly, they would have known about the concerns about the contract, and they would have insisted that when it was rewritten, that they had full access. I don't know whether or not the contract did give them that, but if it didn't, then that was a failing on the part of audit, because they should have insisted that they had the ability to audit the system. We do know that in 2010, post office senior executives took a decision that Horizon must not be subjected to a formal system audit, because by that time, this is a year after Computer Weekly broke the story about concerns about Horizon and about possibly unjust prosecutions. That was in 2009, and a year later, the post office's response was to decide that Horizon must not be system audited because they thought that if people knew that the system was being audited, they would infer that the post office lacked confidence in the system. And the stance of post office senior management was, we have complete confidence in the system and it must not be audited, because that would imply that we doubt the system. And I think that was a deeply, deeply irresponsible line to take. And amazingly, to me anyway, post office, Royal Mail, as it was then, the Royal Mail internal audit was not involved in that decision about whether Horizon should be subjected to a system audit. Internal auditors have huge, great powers, and they've got the independence that allows them to decide what they will audit, what they will look at. I know that the post office internal audit department had a charter that allowed them access to any employees, to any documents. And that's exactly the same power and independence that we had when I was working as a system auditor. Like the post office internal audit department, we reported straight to the board, not to executive management. Internal auditors should report to non-executive directors on the board, which gives them independence from any attempted intimidation or bullying from executive management. So I find it really quite astonishing that post office internal audit did not step in to insist that they would perform a rigorous system audit. It was a large corporation. They should have been staffed up to have sufficient competent staff to do it, and they should have insisted that they would do it. And there's no evidence at all that such an audit was done. When Paula Venables was challenged on that point by a House of Commons Select Committee, she insisted that a gold standard audit was performed by Ernst & Young, the external auditors. But she was actually referring to it was an audit model called SAS-70, which is looking at the management controls applied to a whole IT installation. It doesn't look at the processing integrity of individual systems. Now, the management control, you know, security, backup and recovery, change control, these are all extremely important, but these can all be in place and individual systems can be seriously flawed. there is no, she did not offer in, when she was challenged about Horizon having been audited, she did not offer any evidence to suggest that there had been an audit, an appropriate audit. She simply misled the committee by referring to a form of audit that was irrelevant to the question. And it's quite clear that there was never a proper system audit, as I would have understood it, carried out. A system audit that tries to establish whether the system has processing integrity.
Talking about the processing integrity, one of the issues that has been discussed is that of access to be able to change the data. Can you explain a little bit about how that actually panned out? Because anybody that works in IT knows that you have to be able to get into to change the data at times. It's the nature of it.
Exactly.
So, I believe that it was claimed that nobody had access to it, but they did. What was that all about?
The post office in Fujitsu claimed repeatedly over the years that nobody apart from the sub-postmasters was able to change branch data. And that was, as you say, that was never plausible to anyone that works in IT. That we know that sometimes changes have to be made, even if the system is working perfectly and there aren't any errors. There has to be some facility. If you haven't got some ability to change data centrally, how are you going to do, what are your backup and restore procedures? The people who are managing the system have to be able to change it under certain controlled circumstances. In 2011, the external auditors, in their management letter following their annual audit, reported that Fujitsu were not managing the system properly. They did not have an appropriate level of control over technical staff with high privilege levels. They were able to, there was no record of what they were doing with these privilege levels. And that, as I say, that was in 2011, and the problem had still not been fully resolved by 2015. The only record that was being kept was that staff were logging on and logging off without any indication of what they were doing. In the Horizon Issues case, there was quite a striking phrase that was used in evidence, and that Fujitsu, it was revealed in a Fujitsu document that high privilege levels were extremely useful for technical staff for when they went off-piste.
Off-piste? That is a very strange term to use.
It's really quite significant, yes. And it was, as I say, as I said earlier, I worked for 3 years as an information security manager in large outsourced accounts with IBM. And I was always in at the start when we took over the service, and maybe for a month or two before that. And one of the first things I had to do was to ensure that the high privilege levels were being managed, that there was an appropriate level of control over them so that people could not simply go in and change data. If they were making changes, it had to be in a tightly controlled process. The idea that systems programmers, database administrators could have standing access to live data was just quite unacceptable. It was a fairly basic part of my job to ensure that that was tied down tightly right at the start of the outsourcing service. But we know that for nearly 20 years after Fujitsu took on the service, they'd not got that problem resolved. And if you've not got a problem resolved, 10, 15 years, you're never going to, it's an indication that the culture is seriously wrong. If you haven't got things tied down by that stage, it's clear that management has no real interest or ability in managing the service properly.
Something that you've been involved in more recently is the legal aspects of this, and the fact that in law it's considered that computer evidence is gospel.
Yes.
It's veritas. So
yes.
How have you been involved in discussing that? I know you've been involved with the Law Commission and with the organisation that's currently trying to change that acceptance in law. So how do you get involved in that?
The group that I'm working with, it's an informal group of lawyers and IT academics. And they've been campaigning about this for years, and they've been getting nowhere up till now. It's this presumption applies only to England and Wales. And the presumption is that computer evidence is reliable unless the other party in a court case can explain why it's flawed. And that puts a completely unrealistic burden on the other party. If you're a defendant in a court case like the sub-postmasters, evidence that's provided against you will be believed unless you can demonstrate why it's flawed. And I mean, if it's extremely difficult for testers or auditors to identify how a problem has arisen, if they've got full access to the system and they have the technical expertise to investigate, it's not a trivial job. But the defendants, who are just simple, straightforward users, were put in the position where they had to try and explain what had gone wrong within the system when they had no access, when the post office were not disclosing the details of how the system worked or the errors that they knew about. And so in effect, the presumption of computer evidence reliability flips the burden of proof. It means that defendants were required to prove that they didn't, to prove that they were innocent, to prove that they didn't commit the crime. In fact, in one case, a defendant was challenged to prove how they didn't commit the crime.
For anybody that works in the industry, this seems insane, because we all know that logs are editable. That's the whole point.
Yes, and it was you mentioned the Law Commission. I have not worked with the Law Commission. I have written about them in some detail, because in England and Wales, this presumption was brought about because the Law Commission recommended it in 1997. And clearly the very learned and respected lawyers and judges who took part in the commission and who wrote the report recommending this presumption, clearly they had no understanding at all of how computer systems work, of what their nature is. They continually used police breathalyzer equipment as an analogy, as if a relatively simple breathalyzer kit was essentially the same as a massive, complex, distributed financial system. They didn't understand what they were doing, and they consulted, and they took evidence from people who did understand technology, from computer experts, and they misrepresented the evidence that they were provided with. And I read the report. I was puzzled by it. I couldn't understand why they'd reach such bizarre conclusions after speaking to reputable experts. And I managed to get in touch with two of these experts and discussed what had happened. And they confirmed that their views were misrepresented by the Law Commission. They had argued for the opposite of a presumption of reliability, but the Law Commission presented their evidence as if it backed that presumption. It was a fairly shocking episode. And I know that the legal article I wrote about it has been seen by the Law Commission, which is now under new leadership, and it's been picked up by some politicians. And I'm hoping that I'm hoping that the law will get changed and that there will be a more realistic treatment of computer evidence. In Scotland, the position's different. Computer evidence does not have any special treatment. It's just another form of evidence. And in court, any single form of evidence requires some independent corroboration. So computer evidence might be presented, but it will only be accepted if there's something to back that up. In the Horizon cases, it might have been that a corroborative evidence might have been that the defendant had £50,000 appeared in their bank account, or they'd been spending money recklessly. However, what was striking in the Horizon cases was that there was never any real corroborative evidence to back up the computer evidence. In England and Wales, people were convicted solely on the basis of the computer evidence. And in Scotland, it seems that corroboration did not work as well as it should have done. And in effect, what prosecutors were doing was relying on the computer evidence, but in a different form, taking two different aspects of Horizon evidence and regarding it as being corroborative.
To summarise, to sort of like try and pull this together, because this is a hugely complex case with lots of aspects.
Yes.
What do you think the lessons learned are? What should we take away from this whole episode and learn from it so that similar things don't happen again?
There has to be greater realism about the difficulties of building reliable computer systems.
There
needs to be more emphasis on the job being done properly, on reliable development, effective testing, and there should also be companies or organizations who are wanting courts to rely on their evidence need to be able to demonstrate that they have developed and managed their systems responsibly. And that's something that the Post Office was never required to do. The development and management of Horizon was seriously flawed all the way through, but the Post Office never had to provide anything to demonstrate that they were managing the problem responsibly. Now, if the law changes and organisations have to be able to demonstrate greater responsibility, I think that will also entail, I think, greater legal accountability. The organisations who develop software will have to, I think they'll need a different mindset. They won't simply be able to develop software that they think is more or less okay and push it out. They will have to be able to show that they've taken all reasonable steps to produce a system that is good enough for the purpose for which it's required. And I don't think that there has been sufficient attention to that. I think that the testing job is going to be more difficult and more demanding in the future, because systems are only going to become more complex. And I don't think it's going to be, I think it's going to be a much more, I think it'll be a higher profile job and a higher status job, because it will be much more difficult. It'll be impossible to do the job effectively if you're simply running through scripts that have been driven by the requirements. You'll need people who will be able to look at systems, inspect them, understand what they're doing, understand what the risks might be when it goes live, explain what we can know about these systems, what we don't yet know, and who'll be able to explain clearly in non-technical language what the implications are of what we found as testers about these systems. I think that the roles of testers and auditors might well start, well, not merge, but I think they might start to work more closely together. And I'd like to see testers having some of the independence that auditors have got.
That used to be one of the themes, independent test function, but it seems to have disappeared more now, especially with more agile ways of working where you have embedded testers within the development teams, which is an approach that does work.
Yes, there might be a split in the testing profession between those who are deeply embedded and are far from being independent, and those who have sufficient independence to be able to say that the system is seriously flawed and who cannot be lent upon by program management to simply toe the line, and who can resist having the testing window squeezed if development overruns.
That would be wonderful if it does go that way.
Because when what you referred to as independent testing functions in the past, they didn't have anything like the independence that IT auditors have. They were still responsible to executive management. And I'm wondering, and I'm hoping, that there might be people with good testing skills who maybe get drawn into internal audit to perform some form of audit before systems go live. Testers have got the technical skills required to dive deeply into systems and to explain what's happening, to explain what they've found. And if they work closely with IT auditors, the auditors can guide them about the implications of problems. They can, the interfaces are where things, serious problems often arise when a system is feeding data into an existing business critical system. IT auditors have to understand the implications of all these interfaces, how all the systems fit together. And auditors have to understand the risks that the organization's facing. And I think that they can guide testers so that they're looking at the right things, and testers should have the skills to actually provide answers to questions that the auditors are asking. So I think that if IT auditors and testers are working closely together, I think that could be really interesting, and it could be a very attractive job for testers.
I think it would be attractive if it gets the level of respect that's necessary for it to be effective.
Yes, and if we don't go down that route, I think software suppliers could find themselves in increasing trouble, because I was really struck by the comments of the judge in the Horizon Issues case, who was quite scathing about Post Office and Fujitsu management. And he never actually referred to the original requirements or the specifications to which Horizon had been built. He was focusing on what he understood the system ought to be doing. And that was at some variance with what Fujitsu and the Post Office were thinking. They both thought of the system as being an accounting system for the Post Office, and whereas the judge was regarding it as a system that allowed sub-postmasters to manage their branches. And looked at from that perspective, it was clearly a seriously flawed system, even if the Post Office thought that it was actually good enough for their own purposes.
It's interesting because this reflects very strongly on one of the themes that I'm very keen on, which is quality. And the whole concept of quality isn't just does it adhere to the spec? Does it adhere to the requirements? It's a much bigger factor. It's where the exploratory comes in. It's where the understanding of how user behavior and user experience fits in. It's the entire building in quality by design right from the start, so that they're building the right system as well as building it right.
Yes. Yes. And yeah, Horizon, one of the reasons Horizon was flawed was because, as I said, the developers were always focusing on the happy path, trying to make sure the system did what it was meant to do without thinking about what it must prevent. And it was only when bugs arose that they gave more serious thought to implicit requirements about what the system obviously shouldn't do. And so they were continually, it was never built properly in the first place.
I think that's probably a good point to wrap up the conversation. Thank you very much for this very insightful session. You're very kindly going to be coming down to Edinburgh to present on the 24th of April for the Scottish Testing Group. There's going to be more announcements about that closer to the day, but hopefully that's going to give even more detailed insight into not only the scandal, but the role of testing and auditing and how that all works together. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. I mean, people have only just skimmed the surface of what happened, because this is a scandal that's gone on for almost a quarter of a century, and there's so many aspects to it and so many failures. It's going to be a case study for how we've built and managed systems badly. In the 1990s, 2000s, 2010s, because it's a fairly extreme example of everything going wrong.
Indeed, indeed. So, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brian.
So, thank you to James, and thank you for listening. Check out the show notes for links to James's blog and to the book he mentions, and join us next time for more quality conversations about quality.